and welcome to Ask an Atheist with Sam Mulvey. You got me, Becky Friedman, in the host chair today, and sorry, with Sam Mulvey, don't have any Sam today, but I am super excited to have Josh and Luke in the studio with me. How are you, Luke?
Doing great.
And Josh?
Doing pretty good.
You know, guys, what this weekend is, or what this week, this, I don't know, time. Time is escaping me.
Well, if you take Friday off, then it counts.
Okay, that's fair. Do you guys know what happens this week?
It's Halloween.
Yes, the most demonic of holidays of all. I'm already starting to get little tracts handed into us that are Halloween themed, so that's fun.
Last
2 weeks ago, I guess one of our listeners that came to our post show said, "Hey, this got left in a hardware store." Actually, that was Justin, one of our rotating hosts, that was in a hardware store, and it was just this, you know, anti-Halloween tract that was left at the end of, one of those drawers of screws and stuff?
Drawer of bolts.
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
That's
just
weird.
In the back of it. They just place it there. How much do they charge? I mean, so people buy these Chick Tracks in bulk, and so how much does it cost to buy them in bulk?
I think a few thousand dollars. To get a pack of 10,000 with your church or your ministry printed on the back of them is sort of like what it costs.
So, hey, Christians, when you tithe, just understand this is where your money goes.
I am in the wrong business.
Oh, you want to be in the tract-making business?
Not really, but geez, they make a lot of money.
You could do a counter-tract business.
Yeah.
And then they could do a counter-counter-tract business, and then we can do a counter-track to the third power.
We need to go electronic and not be having so much paper waste.
Yeah, that'd be nice.
So that's why we're on, you know, the radio, atheist.radio, and Ask an Atheist.
You got to keep Dunder Mifflin in business.
Is that
Jobs.
A publishing company?
It's from The Office.
Oh, yeah. Okay. All right. I am not one that watches all of the popular culture tropes and things like that, but I do participate in the popular culture trope of Halloweening. I am going to be dressing up in my Michelangelo Ninja Turtle costume and doing an entire day professionally working in the school where I am a consummate professional, but I'll be wearing
nice.
Michelangelo. I'm going to carry around an empty pizza box too, I think. Now, in your job sites, do you guys get to, you know, dress up or be funny or anything like that?
Will not.
No.
We already had our Halloween party last weekend, actually, over at Kitsap. My cross is still turned upside down.
Oh, were you a satanic priest or something? Like
no,
that?
No, I just actually end up leaving it turned upside down all the time because it's funny.
Okay. And Josh, are you into Halloween? Do you get trick or treaters at your place or?
No, we're pretty well isolated, so we barely ever get anybody.
Okay, all right.
I live in a nice little cul-de-sac, so I've got like 80 candy bars ready to go.
Nice.
Full size or fun size?
Full size.
Oh, I'm coming to your place.
Beautiful. And so when it gets to be 9 p.m., you know, the last trick-or-treater, you're just going to, you know, dump the whole bucket into their
bag? What I end up doing is I give them a handful and then give myself a few handfuls.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah, that's how it turns out. It's like nobody ever shows up my place, so I got candy forever.
That's the kind of tithing that I approve of. You heard it here on Ask an Atheist, where we tithe in chocolate form or
yes.
Fruity gummy form. Yeah. Well, you know, not all things are so peachy and rosy and happy and candy-like and things like that, because there's still people trying to, you know, harass and intimidate children, you know, and not through scary costumes by saying boo and trick or treat. A school district in Georgia has reversed a policy that would have allowed transgender students to use the restroom of their gender rather than facilities corresponding to their sex assigned at birth. The policy put Pickens County Schools in alignment with the finding of the 2018 case Adams v. the School Board of St. Johns County, Florida, which directed a school to let student Drew Adams use the boys' room at his school. After implementing the policy, Pickens County Schools experienced death threats, student harassment, and vandalism of school property. The district put forth a press release indicating that until it can consult with law enforcement and other safety professionals, trans students will revert to utilizing gender-neutral staff restrooms. Superintendent Carlton Wilson stated that name-calling at public hearings had been embarrassing and disappointing, and lamented one commenter who had stated that situations like these brings out crazy people from both sides and sometimes people die.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure people have only died from one side, and that
both sides.
Both sides is such a stupid argument.
This the false equivalency. What are the things that we have here that we're equating, or that this one particular commenter is equating on? On one side, we have folks that are saying if you allow trans kids to use the bathroom in this way with other kids who are not transgender, then I will be forced to kill you. And on the other side, you have a 14-year-old that just wants to not be terrified in a high school restroom, right?
Oh, yeah, totally equivalent. I mean, there is no disparity between those two positions at all, man, whatsoever.
The thing about this also is that, hey, we need to consult with law enforcement to ensure safety for everyone. You know what ensures safety for those trans kids that are so much more likely to be bullied and to be attacked and things like that? You know, letting them use the bathroom that corresponds to their gender.
So very difficult to understand.
So I would say one plus side. I mean, it's still completely wrong, but using probably a staff bathroom is a lot cleaner than a boys' bathroom, because
that's true.
So my middle school, we had this kid, we don't know whoever did it, would regularly just pee on the heat radiator.
Oh, terrible. Yeah. Children, stop. Don't do that. Don't be that kid. Don't be that guy.
We had phantom poopers from time to time.
We never had that, but oh man, the whole hallway would always reek.
Ugh.
So using a single stall staff bathroom that, you know, doesn't correspond to any particular gender, just corresponds to a person needing to use the restroom. Right. Maybe you'll.
It's cleaner, but
if they're everywhere, then it's probably preferable. But still, the point is they should not be denied the right to use.
It singles them out for bullying, and that's just not okay.
Oftentimes, also, staff restrooms are not centrally located in different schools. It was considered not an acceptable alternative, an option, because, you know, then you're going far away, you're out of class for, you know, longer periods of time, missing instruction, or you're taking more time during your passing periods, making you late to your next class. That could result in discipline. And so it's not an ideal, you know, and workable solution. That's why we say, and that's why memorandums from the, you know, education departments at state levels and, you know, through different court rulings will say, no, if you have a kid and they identify as a boy and all of their markers are changed, or even if they aren't changed, you know, on all of their paperwork, you allow them to use the restroom that corresponds to the restroom they want to use. And if we were just to focus on that, as opposed to all the terrible myriad things that happen in high school and middle school restrooms, maybe this wouldn't be such a big deal. Maybe the reason that people are so concerned for their safety or their child's safety when they might be encountering a trans kid in a restroom is because they're remembering all of the terrible stuff that can go down in unsupervised and you know, unwatched middle school and high school bathrooms.
Yeah, kids can be vicious on their own devices, but kids can be especially vicious when they're actually told that they have a reason to be.
Well, and in this case, they're being told by their parents and their community members who are up there yelling and you know, making death threats and saying that this is unbiblical and you're redefining what this means. And it's,
you're totally justified because, you know, false equivalency.
And Luke, what were you going to say?
Well, isn't there like some statistic where you're more likely to be molested in a bathroom by a Republican senator than a trans person?
I'm not sure that might be a case of their statistics and their lies and damn statistics. But yeah, we do see a lot of sort of untoward activities perpetrated by male Republican individuals that seem to come out with these scandals at higher rates. Now, I will say that if you're a male Republican senator or elected official and you're trying to pick up someone in a restroom and engage in consensual interchange of social interactions, be they verbal or otherwise, that's not something that qualifies as molestation, nor is that a safety issue. I would think that the only safety issue there is, again, the cleanliness of the bathroom. but to have these kids, you know, be faced with community members coming to meetings and yelling death threats to officials that are supporting them. What's that going to say? If the officials who are allies to these kids are getting death threats, then, you know, then what's it going to feel like to these kids? The huge thing of the crazies on both sides, one of the particular sides actually had a parent of a child say, if you disagree with this policy, if you say that trans kids shouldn't use the bathroom that corresponds to their gender, but rather to their biological sex assigned at birth, then, and if you disagree with that, and if my kids disagree with that, you as a school district are bullying my Christian kids. And to me, that just exemplifies this overly exaggerated sense of folks who claim Christian persecution. And for that, for another example of exemplifying that, I'm going to take us into the breakfast world. Did you guys have breakfast today?
I did.
A bagel.
Okay, you had a bagel. What about you, Luke?
I had a Jimmy Dean breakfast sandwich croissant-wich thing.
Okay, yeah. I had an omelet with some vegetables in it. Cool. But none of us had cereal, funny enough.
No, I had that yesterday.
So this actually is about cereal, believe it or not. Could you think that cereal gets into the foray of gender politics and religion?
Well, Christians think they own everything, so no surprise there.
Well, Kellogg's recently created a limited edition cereal called All Together that features its best known cereal lines combined into one bag. The purple box features cartoon mascots like Frosted Flakes Tony the Tiger, Rice Krispies Snap, Crackle, and Pop, Fruit Loops Toucan Sam, and the smiling sun from Raisin Bran. Kellogg stated that the product line is a symbol of acceptance no matter how you look, where you're from, or who you love, and was released in honor of the Gay and Lesbian Alliance Against Defamation's 2019 Anti-Bullying Spirit Day. High-profile Christian conservatives like Ken Ham called the product an example of anti-Christian marketing and asserted that the LGBTQ lifestyle slash worldview is anti-God, anti-biblical, and anti-science. The parenting branch of the evangelical group, the American Family Association, accused the company of using cereal mascots to brainwash children to normalize being LGBTQ. Guys, where do we start with this?
Well, first, being inclusive is obviously anti-Christian.
Obviously.
Yes.
Because, you know, I mean, what that says there is if you're saying that inclusivity is anti-Christian, you're literally admitting to Christianity being exclusionary, saying that we believe as Christians that these people are not human, they are on the outside. And like, do you really want to be doing that? Is that the angle that you want to take on this?
So this cereal sounds wonderful. Where can I get it?
Oh, well, to those that are wondering whether it is mere virtue signaling, I might be inclined to agree since it's only available online and it's apparently like $20. So it's totally a novelty item.
Oh, does any of that $20 go to supporting any group? Like all of that money has to go?
So,
or is it just a cash grab?
So Kellogg's actually is making a donation to GLAAD. That's the Gay and Lesbian Alliance Against Defamation. To the tune of $50,000.
Which, that's nice.
To an organization, to a nonprofit, that can be a big chunk of money. To a huge corporation like Kellogg's, like that seems like some little hand-waving drop in the bucket. There's that. The altogether cereal concept is one that I'm a little skeptical of. And comparing people to things that you eat, that you consume, that you ingest, I'm also a little skeptical of as well. But seeing all of the mascots all together, it's sort of like when Hanna-Barbera would take all of the different cartoon characters and just put them all together in one big show.
Oh, those are fun.
Yeah, they're fun, but they never made sense.
No, they never
did. The crossover episodes were just like, we're just going to put random characters and act like they belong.
Yeah, it kind of makes me wonder how the original owner of the Kellogg's company would think about this whole situation.
Tell us about the original owner of the Kellogg's company.
The only thing I really know about it is a little bit I've read, and there's this movie about him called The Road to Wellville, and he invented cornflakes as a anti self pleasuring aid. The blandness apparently is the thing. The movie was meh. I enjoyed it, but I thought it was pretty funny. But I don't know how he'd feel about it.
Well, when you look at that history of cereal, I had known about it in terms of, like, I think General Mills and Grape Nuts, that these really bland cereals were supposed to be wholesome.
Right.
but distract you from the worldly pleasures of being a sexually mature adult, right? Something like that.
Yeah, I guess that could do it, but still.
Being, I don't know how eating something super bland correlates to anti-onanist practices, if you will.
I can see the cornflakes is bland, but...
So you guys know all the mascots and everything?
Oh.
So we've got like Tony the Tiger.
Yeah.
And the sun that's smiling on the Kellogg's Raisin Bran, the two scoops, and the sun actually has a face. So like that, right. I guess that's a mascot. I hadn't eaten or seen a box of cornflakes in so long that I forgot there was a mascot associated with it. But it's that green rooster. Did you guys know that the rooster, the cornflakes rooster, actually has a name?
It's not cock, is it?
No, it is. It is not. That is his category of animal naming.
Yes.
No, his name is Cornelius, apparently.
Oh, that makes
Cornelius.
Sense. Cornelius.
The rooster.
Cornflakes.
Is that from, like, I mean, how long has Cornelius been with us?
That's not something that I have looked at. I'm sure there's a Wikipedia article on it somewhere. But, you know, actually, if you're looking at cornflakes as sort of the first thing, because Frosted Flakes grew out of cornflakes because cornflakes was too bland. And so by the time they get to like
sugar on it,
what Frosted Flakes are delicious.
Yeah. And correlates to no, you know, increase in certain other personal practices, I would imagine. But I don't know. But does having the rooster as your mascot really, is that the character that you want if you're going to stress practices of modesty, of sexual modesty, and religiosity and piety? is the rooster really the symbol that you want?
I mean, as roosters are, probably not, but I'm sure he was thinking when he created it, like the pastoral qualities of a rooster, waking up at dawn and, you know, all those awful things.
Okay, well, the crazy thing here is putting together all of your cereal in a way that says, hey, LGBT people exist, and we're cool with having kids not be bullied in schools, so wear purple on this particular day, and it evokes the ire of people that says you are being anti-Christian.
Right.
Like, that would be like, I mean, you guys know this. I grew up Jewish, right? That would be like if I had said, as a practicing Jew, that the existence, the mere existence of Hormel Foods, which uses pork in its products, is anti-Semitic. Now, in no way am I claiming now as an atheist that Hormel Foods existing is evidence of anti-Semitism, nor would I ever have dreamed of doing that as an observant Jew. It's baffling to me why you can think that this is anti-Christian.
Remember that Ken Ham, he's the guy that believes the Earth's 6,000 years old.
Just one of the guys.
One of the guys. I mean, he has a whole museum about the Ark and the Creationist Museum and all that. So, I mean, science may not be his strong suit.
Well, just he gets to determine what science is, so how dare you. So Cornelius was born in 1957.
Okay.
So well beyond John.
Yeah.
Passing this mortal coil.
Okay.
And actually, towards the end, like when John came up with I'm repeating this from a podcast I heard a couple days ago, but basically John and his brother were part of the company, the Kellogg company, and they had a patent dispute after the cornflakes came out, and so John didn't really get to enjoy his invention for very long because he basically got sued out of it. Basically, Cornelius was brought in after any doctrine about masturbation was
eliminated from their marketing schemes.
Yeah.
Well, you heard it here on Ask an Atheist with Sam Mulvey. I don't know what we'll be talking about next. Maybe a little bit of, I don't know, someone's journey, someone's pathway, much in the way of the Kellogg's company, from religious to explicitly non-religious and inclusive. You're listening to Ask an Atheist. Hello, and welcome back to Ask an Atheist with Sam Mulvey. You still got me, Becky Friedman, in the studio, along with Luke. And I'm I'm super excited because we have another Luke joining us on this particular segment today. I want to welcome Luke Douglas. He is a former fundamentalist Christian who is now the first full-time paid executive director of the Humanist Society of Greater Phoenix, someplace that's near and dear to Sam and my hearts, as we did an episode during our 2013 Two Oil Change tour at Humanist Society Greater Phoenix. Luke's experience spans the political spectrum on the campaign trail, the legislative gallery, and the court of law. Welcome to the show, Luke Douglas.
Hey, Becky. Thanks for having me on.
You grew up as a fundamentalist Christian, and what exactly did that mean in your case? I mean, what was your childhood and adolescence like?
Well, I was definitely homeschooled. Young Earth creationism was a huge emphasis of my primary and secondary education, very patriarchal approach to family roles and leadership inside the church, and a fair share of doomsday prepping while we were at it. So it was a very dyed-in-the-wool evangelical experience.
What kind of doomsday prepping? I mean, tell us about that, because that, you know, you say, just a little bit of doomsday prepping, you know, no big deal. That feels like a real big deal to me.
Well, my childhood bedroom is stacked floor to ceiling with 50-pound sacks of grain that are stockpiled in case Western civilization collapses because the secularists erode the foundations of society.
Oh, dang.
Wow.
Look at the power of us eroding the foundations of society. More powerful than raging rivers. In terms of being homeschooled, were you exposed to any kind of, any kind of secular studies, or was it really just colored by young earth creationism? I mean, did you learn like mathematics? Did you read, you know, any classics or things like that?
I definitely fall into what you would call the homeschool math gap, where I've had to go back and really educate myself on STEM as an adult. A lot of fundamentalist homeschoolers will take what they call a liberal arts approach, which involves some classics, but it's sort of from this perspective that you're only learning about outside perspectives in order to be able to debate with them more effectively. Mm. You only learn about evolution in order to be able to refute it more effectively. And what they'll do is actually increase the dosage of what you hear about evolution as you get older and make sure that the creationist counterpoints are more convincing at each level where you start, you know, in high school being introduced to some quotes by Sagan or some quotes by Charles Darwin and reading Charles Darwin's books in order to sort of prepare yourself to go out and not be persuaded in the outside world.
In that whole education, that homeschool education, you actually kind of got involved in politics pretty early, right?
Oh, yeah. I fell in love and I still enjoy being involved in the political scene, though my first exposure was in a very conservative and libertarian-leaning type perspective that was, you know, natural to my worldview.
You know, you had talked about in previous kind of interviews and things that are available online, and that you were considered at one point a rising star within Tea Party events. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah. I started volunteering for campaigns when I was 15, and I started networking within the local conservative scene in the Pacific Northwest. I actually grew up in Oregon, not that far away from you all, but started getting invited to speak at some local, you know, fairly small Tea Party type events, and being seen as a possible, you know, source of hope for their next generation because their movement was so old in its demographics that they were excited to see a 16, 17-year-old who would sort of rally for their cause.
So you grew up in Oregon. Are there important things for humanists to know about fundamentalist Christianity in the Pacific Northwest?
I would say that being in a sort of perpetual 45-55 minority does a lot to galvanize people because, you know, Oregon is really pretty safely a blue state, but not by a very wide margin. It's a state that tends to vote for Democrats overall, but there are still enough conservative evangelical people who live just outside the Portland metro area that they live in a world where their views are normal in their communities and in their churches, but they don't feel a need to talk to any middle because they're not competitive at the statewide level anyway.
Right. Washington is very similar there in many ways.
You know, it might be easy to see that, you know, as this young 17, 18-year-old kid within Tea Party events, you kind of are that token young person. You know, now being someone within the secular and humanist movement, Do you ever now feel tokenized as this young person? Because as a leader, you are still under 30, if I may, you know, draw attention to that. Do you ever find the same kind of reaction or feeling in that way?
Not particularly. I found that regardless of party affiliation, volunteer circles and nonprofit organizations tend to have older membership because it's people whose kids are grown and gone, and so they have time and money to dedicate to causes they believe in. That's pretty much universal, and I am younger than most people in any nonprofit world. The margin is just a little smaller in the humanist world.
Ah, I got it. That's an interesting way of looking at some of those similarities between different groups. Now, you met your wife when you were both evangelical Christians, and you've managed to stay together. She wasn't your wife at the time that you stepped away and lost your faith, but how did your leaving fundamentalist faith play out in your relationship?
Well, we were both in the doubting part of the journey when we met, and I think being able to bond over having questions that neither of us had strong answers to allowed us to sort of evolve in parallel directions, even though the pacing sometimes led to tension, even though, you know, the fact that I went all the way and said I am an atheist with a hard A before she was even remotely ready to talk about that, you know, the direction of change made it possible.
Can you actually tell us a little bit about your experience getting to that big A atheist? Going from someone who was homeschooled as a young earth creationist and active within politics and mission work to being an atheist activist?
Yeah. I wanted to be the best Christian apologist that I could be. And so I studied different points of view. I studied philosophy. I actually hosted a debate watch party for the Ken Ham and Bill Nye debate on the legitimacy of creationism.
You know, I think a lot of atheists were also hosting watch parties as
there
well,
are many
right?
Of us.
Right. And I was blown away by how severely my childhood icon was just destroyed. And I realized I didn't know enough to be a better advocate than Ken Ham had been. And I said, I have to study evolution and study astronomy and study these things so that when it's my turn to debate the Bill Nyes of the world, I'll be a better face for creationism than Ken Ham was. And so inevitably, here we are. So I just recently published my deconversion story on the Christian Post under the title, I Lost My Faith in a Chick-fil-A.
In terms of publishing this in the Christian Post, I think that that's somewhat anathema to a lot of atheists and humanists, especially public-facing ones, to interface with a journalistic outlet that has such an explicitly religious bent to it and editorial, you know, policy and worldview. What motivated you to work and collaborate with the Christian Post in that way?
Well, about a month ago, they put out a call for deconversion stories. They said, if you've fallen away from the faith, we want to hear from you. And it was pretty obvious in the context that they were looking to create apologetics training materials. They want to give, you know, Christian apologists the material they need to reach people who are falling away. And so it is a double-edged sword, but I think it's one that can be used effectively when, you know, free thought is dedicated to dialogue. You have to be willing to engage in some of these tough conversations and know that there are doubting Christians who read publications like that. And on the other side, there are, you know, more progressive Christian leaders who are legitimately trying to work for progress within religious institutions, and they need tangible steps to improve the church from within.
Can we back up just a little second here? How would you explain or define what apologetics are? Because we see that word apology in it, and we think, oh, it must be saying sorry for all the wrongs we've done. But it really means something different, right? And since you were trained as the expert on it, can you kind of unpack that for us?
Yeah, it's from a verse in, I believe it's 1 Peter, though it's been a while since I memorized most of the New Testament, where Peter says to be ready always to give an answer for the hope that lies within you. Essentially, to anyone who asks, you have to be able to explain your faith in a, it's been interpreted to be a consistent, logical, a persuasive way. And the Greek word is apologia for answer.
So how did your training there impact your success as a lawyer in your early career?
It's incredible how much those two overlap. For one thing, the more fundamentalist you are within Christianity, the more you tend to see the Bible in the way that a lawyer sees legal authority, as opposed to a more progressive interpretation that might be more like a literary scholar or an art critic see something that's open to interpretation. So you were already coming in with the sort of mechanical view of how to approach, you know, the biblical text. And then you go to law school and you learn to argue for both sides of a case. And it's just part of the process to be able to argue for your opponent's case as well as you can argue for your own.
You know, it's interesting that you compare a biblical godly authority to sort of this legal authority. Do you think that there's something inherent in our American justice system and legal system that prioritizes and idolizes the word, the law, beyond where it should be?
That's an interesting question. I think that any system that's built with a hierarchical structure and deference to authority inherently has that undertone. And so our legal system has this heritage of social hierarchy and people telling other people what to do. And the state has been a facet of that. And the church has also been historically a facet of that system. So yeah, I think that the historic muddling between church and state inevitably leads to some problematic places.
So, Luke, reading a little bit into your background, you and I actually have a shared experience in reading Baruch Spinoza and using his philosophy as sort of that bridge into agnosticism. Can you talk a little bit about why his philosophy resonated with you?
Yeah, and for a little bit of context, you're referring to the fact that I had Spinoza's book about deism in my hand when I was in the Chick-fil-A, when I realized I was an atheist, and I dropped the book and essentially went into the men's room and cried.
Yeah.
Bawled my eyes out for about an hour. I was reading Spinoza's book where he sort of goes through the Christian, Jewish, and Muslim conceptions of God. And he looks at all the similarities and the different prophets who have caught glimpses of this sort of deistic, vague, all-present God who is not knowable more specifically than that. And I realized this was everything that I'd been looking for. I'd been looking for a sort of intellectually, an intellectually acceptable version of faith that I could just cut all of the parts I was doubting off from. And when I found it, I realized that it didn't have any meaning compared to intellectual honesty. Because Spinoza's God is so similar to no God that you may as well just be honest that you're not convinced.
I think that I had a very similar experience at some point in high school, and I gravitated towards Spinoza because of his Jewish heritage. And I said, oh, see, there's a way that I can be Jewish. And because other people within my cultural past have had these kinds of ideas, too. And so it was really fascinating to hear that that was something that resonated with someone who didn't have that shared heritage as me. Were you, in terms of reading Spinoza, was that something that was for your, apologetics, or were you kind of sneakily reading this? I'm going to read from a philosopher of a different faith.
Well, see, I delved into philosophy, especially after I started having more time on my hands after the bar exam. And I went roughly in chronological order from the ancient Greeks and through all these different time periods. It definitely started out as I want to learn more about different systems of thought so that I can defend Christianity, and very gradually turned into honest curiosity. And I don't really know where the turning point was that I realized I wasn't just looking to reinforce my own beliefs, but actually open to changing them. And so when I got to Spinoza, you know, Spinoza's a person, as I recall, actually grew up in Spain and had to flee during the Spanish Inquisition. You know, he's fleeing persecution at the hands of Christian fundamentalists in his time and place, and seeing sort of this team that I was rooting for on such a wrong side of history, and a person who, you know, relocates to a more secular, multicultural place that was, you know, the Netherlands in the 17th century, being able to then, you know, talk about comparative religion so freely was really moving.
Can you talk about how your change in religious belief mirrored a change in your career focus?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I, you know, have been a political activist professionally in one capacity or another since I was 18, from my first, you know, full-time job. And going into that route, you know, obviously on the conservative side, on the libertarian side, that made sense from my worldview. But as my faith worldview changed, I realized that a lot of my political views didn't make any sense without that as their foundation. And I ended up ultimately having to start over and become a full-time campaign volunteer to work my way up to being a professional progressive activist.
So now, as a progressive activist and as the director of the Humanist Society of Greater Phoenix, you've got some really amazing kind of projects and initiatives that you're working on. Can you tell us some of those?
Yeah. I don't know if you're familiar with the Freedom From Religion Foundation, as far as you're anyone listening to the conversation, but they actually sued the U.S. government over a provision of the tax code called the parsonage exemption. It's this bit of the tax code that says a minister of the gospel can receive a housing allowance from a house of worship tax-free. And it, you know, income that would be treated as income if it were anyone else making that money. They actually lost at the U.S. Court of Appeals level and decided not to go to the Supreme Court because they thought they would lose, just given the current makeup of the Supreme Court. And so the Humanist Society of Greater Phoenix is actually picking up where they left off and taking a more incremental approach. We're not saying this is unconstitutional, but we are saying if it goes to ministers of the gospel, it should go to equivalent secular leaders.
So does the Humanist Society of Greater Phoenix grant you a housing allowance in order for you to, you know, have your apartment or home or anything like that? Is that sort of the standing on which you're suing?
Yes. So they cut my salary, gave me a portion of it that was defined as a housing allowance for the specific purpose of, you know, seeing if the IRS disagrees. And then if we go from there, we'll litigate up through the constitutional law process.
Interesting. So what's the timeline look on that?
Well, I'll file my taxes early next year, and the IRS, you know, if they don't say anything, then that's, you know, that's a win for secular organizations regardless, because,
right,
you know, we all are emboldened by the first person not having to fight the IRS. Now, if they do disagree, it'll go through the administrative process within the IRS, then to the U.S. Tax Court, and then ultimately the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. Depending on how long it takes for us to decide that, you know, humanist leaders count as clergy or count as the equivalent of clergy for legal purposes.
So you've talked about the goal of diversifying humanist communities and yours in particular. What does diversity mean to you?
Well, diversity should cut across as many dimensions as possible of different people's perspectives. You know, one initial push for diversity is something we already touched on, which is the age diversity, that we have a predominantly older community that's starting to see more and more young people becoming involved. And also, it's true for things like racial and ethnic diversity, different people who are former members of different faiths coming together around the same secular and free thought values. You know, I think it's a wide variety of things.
Now, as a leader of a humanist society that has a building and has regular weekly or monthly events, that can sometimes look a little bit like a church for those folks that are familiar with that and then left a religious belief. And especially when you're looking at filing for, you know, a parsonage exemption and treating yourself essentially as the equivalent to clergy, what does that kind of look like in a humanist context in the Phoenix Valley?
It started with an ordination that the National Humanist Society calls becoming a celebrant, which means I'm legal to perform weddings, and you have that ordination that's, you know, helpful if you want to do funerals and invocations and city council meetings, things of that nature, that I've been stepping into that role in order to take advantage of some of the same privileges that have been extended to, you know, religious leaders, but in a way that says this is not something you own, this is something that humans own, that communities of people need, and that a community that's centered on humanist values can use in the same way. We also meet on Sunday mornings, not every Sunday morning, but, you know, two out of the month. And trying to imitate some of the cultural and community aspects of church without the faith content is something we try to lean into.
Interesting. I personally run or help run a couple of small atheists and skeptics groups out in my area of the state. It's been become pretty clear to me that, you know, not all atheists are humanists. What kind of advice could you give someone like me to starting some sort of small humanist community in our area?
I would say look for people who want atheism, but also something else. You know, atheism is inherently a statement of something you don't believe, not God, but it has nothing
right
to do with what you do believe. And so try and find whether people are interested in doing something instead of, you know, God and worship.
Right.
And if they're interested in taking some of this energy that perhaps used to go into a church, that used to go into, you know, donating and tithing to sustain a house of worship, you know, are they willing to build a community around positive values? Sort of go from there. And not everybody in the atheist world will be a fit. And there are atheist groups around here that, you know, we work with sometimes, and they're not interested in everything we do, and that's fine.
Luke, how can people learn more about the Humanist Society of Greater Phoenix?
Check us out on our Facebook page, Humanist Society of Greater Phoenix, hsgp.org. If you Google my name with parsonage exemption, you'll probably find some of our local news coverage pretty quickly. And we'd be happy to engage in conversations and, you know, just go from there and see how we can trade best practices to grow humanist communities all over the country.
Well, I'm so excited to hear about the new things that Humanist Society of Greater Phoenix has been doing in, you know, the 5 years since Sam and I were there, and we'll be keeping an eye on how that parsonage exemption challenge goes in the future. Luke Douglas is a former fundamentalist Christian who is now the first full-time paid executive director of the Humanist Society of Greater Phoenix, and I'm just so glad that you were able to join us today.
Thanks a lot, Becky. It's a lot of fun.
You've been listening to Ask an Atheist with Sam Mulvey. We'll be back after the break. Hello, and welcome back to Ask an Atheist with Sam Mulvey. Sam's still on break, so you get me, Becky, and Luke, and Josh.
Hi.
Hello.
So, guys, we live in a secular society, right? With a separation of church and state, and, you know, freedom of religion, freedom to not be a believer, and in a place where none of our, government officials shall suggest any, you know, support of religion or non-religion or specific religions, right?
That's my understanding.
Did you hit your head?
What? Apparently I did, because the U.S. State Department briefly updated its homepage to feature Mike Pompeo's October 11th speech entitled Being a Christian Leader, given to a conference of the American Association of Christian Counselors in Nashville. Pompeo's remarks included noting that he asks God for direction in his work and draws upon the wisdom of God to be a force for good, and characterizes his State Department job as that of an imperfect servant serving a perfect God. Apparently, I did hit my head, and we apparently do live in a Christian nation, guys. Help me out with this, because...
Well, Trump thinks he's God, so is he calling Trump perfect?
An imperfect servant serving a perfect Trump. Oh, ooh, that just feels ugly in my mouth, Josh. How dare you? Did you guys see the how they updated the State Department webpage?
Yeah, I did see that.
Yeah, it's, and it, even today, like today is Religious Freedom Day.
Is it?
Yes.
Oh, nice.
So, on the State Department?
On the State Department website.
Now, in terms of having, you know, a Secretary of State or Department of State doing things in other countries, I am completely supportive of the U.S. also pushing the conversation in other places to say, don't persecute people on the basis of religion.
Exactly.
I'm actually supportive of, you know, folks of Christian in Pakistan who is accused of blasphemy literally for just saying that they're a Christian and don't believe in Allah and don't believe that Muhammad is a prophet of Allah. Like, I'm supportive of that Christian that's being persecuted. I'm also supportive of atheist in Sudan who is being persecuted for blaspheming. I'm completely supportive of an atheist in Ireland who, until they overturned their blasphemy laws, you know, couldn't say things without risking fines and imprisonment and stuff like that. So, like, I get that. It's just
that's not the context here.
Yeah, I don't think the State Department really wants to support anyone but Christians.
Oh,
and
guys,
not any Christian, just any Christians, but a very specific subset of Christians.
The ones that are imperfect leaders serving imperfect gods, perfect gods.
A lot
there
of
was
them,
a little slip there, wasn't there?
I think Pompeo would qualify as a WASP.
Okay, so that would be the Anglo-Saxon Protestant variety of religious Christian individuals.
Oof.
So a lot of people then said, oh, look, it's cool because they took it down. They took it down. It's fine. Not realizing that the State Department webpage, when you first go to it, is updated pretty often. You can still find that page. It's not like the State Department did a big old oops and we'll remove it. It's there. We'll link to it in our show notes at atheist.radio. But, you know, when someone says, hey, I ask God for direction in doing my work, like, okay, fine, I guess. Like, I'm not going to have a religious litmus test for you, just as I don't want anyone to have a religious litmus test for me if I'm, you know, being elected to office. And if that's where you get your leadership, okay, as long as it's not telling you to, you know, discriminate against LGBT individuals.
But
and,
it's doing
but
exactly
it definitely
that.
Is that.
Oh, guys, why do you have to keep disappointing me? You know, Josh, you brought up the Trump thing, right? Is he serving Trump and is Trump a god? Because, you know, we've tossed around that Trump, you know, doesn't really seem like a Christian.
He doesn't. Oh, he's just not a Christian. He thinks of himself as a god. Auto theist is, I guess, the term.
Yeah, that's but the one that I bring up when people say Trump's the first atheist president.
The imperfect leader is really popular amongst the evangelical Christian crowds these days, though.
Okay. Yeah, they have to justify their beliefs somehow, and so they're saying, like, he's not perfect, but he's working for a perfect God, so he's justified in his
imperfections?
Yes. He'll be forgiven, and he's doing God's work.
Well, if he's doing God's work, and if Trump is supposed to be doing God's work as well, or if Trump is the God or whatever, in this speech that Pompeo was giving to these Christian counselors at this conference, he literally quoted from the letter to the Colossians saying, let your speech always be gracious. Who in government right now has the least gracious speech?
So you're not talking about Dear Leader, are you?
I'm going to have to think about that one for a while.
I mean, when you're saying, like, speak well because you're an elected leader, he's literally saying that to these Christians serving in the Trump administration.
Yeah.
He is serving to the guy who justifies all of his ugliness, all of his discrimination as saying, oh, that's locker room talk. You know, we're trying to improve the status of middle school bathrooms here. Like, you know, and so the gall to say, I'm going to quote text, I'm going to quote scripture saying, let your speech always be gracious, just is so freaking disingenuous.
And if you're pulling all of your leadership ability from one book, you're doing this wrong.
Well, you're excluding other kinds of perspectives and ideas, and we're supposed to be a pluralistic society, if I'm not mistaken, right?
That's okay. They'll be forgiven.
Oh, what do you mean? What makes
you
think
that's...
Well,
that's
they're forgiven every day. They do their crime, then they pray, and then they're forgiven, so it doesn't matter.
Oh, man. Was that brought up in his speeches, or that's just among the strain of Christianity? That
amongst the idea of an imperfect servant. That right there is the key. It's a pretty common idea that, you know, as humans, we're, you know, inferior and terrible, and we're just prone to do terrible things, and all we have to do is pray for forgiveness.
So one thing that really gives me pause on this, besides the whole mingling of church and state, is Pompeo has been fighting subpoenas for him and other State Department officials to hand over documents related to impeachment inquiries surrounding Ukraine. And if he thinks that God is the one guiding him in his work, is he thinking that God is saying, don't respond to these inquiries? Like, that's a thing that's scary to me. Regardless of whether your book says, you know, discriminate against LGBTQ individuals or do this or that, like, when you're looking at ethics and when you're looking at the functioning of societies in ways that do not have these conflicts of interest and these egregious impeachable offenses, is he thinking that God is telling him hide all that stuff?
I mean, it's weird because it seems like God's telling him whatever he wants to hear every time he wants to hear it. It's amazing.
I
don't know. That's
amazing.
A weird coincidence, but I don't know what that would be called, but
religious belief, perhaps. So he also says to these counselors, we're both in very people intensive lines of work, and we're both appealing to the hearts and minds to change behaviors
and failing massively.
Have you ever had any experience with Christian counselors?
Yes.
Yeah.
I have not.
I've never had good experiences with Christian counselors. They're usually fairly ineffective.
Oh, massively. Me and my wife, we went to a marriage counselor, and the first one they gave us was a Christian. And so every solution that she had was something about the Bible. And I was like, no, we need somebody to actually, a secular counselor.
So when you talk about Christian counselors, you're not just talking about, you know, a social worker or a psychologist or a counselor that happens to be Christian and then uses cognitive behavioral therapy and dialectical therapy and things like that. They're counseling from their Christian faith.
Yes, they'll pull as much from their Christian faith as possible, sometimes going secular. But most of the time, it's just like the Bible determines your position in this marriage.
What an alienating position that must be for the clients, for the patients of these individuals. I mean, imagine just in your two personal recounts, that's just those, you know, personal things. But there's a myriad of conditions and struggles that people go to seek counseling for. And when Pompeo, who is this, you know, very hierarchical, like, head of the State Department, you know, says, yeah, we're in people-intensive lines of work, we're appealing to the hearts and minds to change behaviors, that also feels to me a lot like those conversion missionary talks as well, appeal to their hearts and minds to accept Jesus.
Right.
And that's a scary thing. From both a political perspective and from a mental and behavioral health perspective. You know, this is the guy who back in March actually expressed that it's a possibility that God made Trump president. And not just that, it's possible that God ordained him to be president. Like, that's scary. I thought we did away with that with, you know, divine right kings. But specifically, it's possible that God made Trump president to help save the Jewish people from the Iranian menace. Now, as atheists and as someone who is of Jewish heritage, I'm thinking, what the heck business do you have leading any kind of international politics?
Yeah, and so by his logic, too, also, so he's not going to claim that God gave us Obama. So he's going to say the devil gave us Obama. And so that means the devil gave us Obama for 8 years. So Trump gets voted out of office next year. That means the devil has to be more, twice as powerful as God.
Oh, sweet. Okay.
So I want to see a god off.
I can see where the Satanists have something going on this. Yeah. I'm digging it. Did you mean a god off? Meaning like, okay, Satan versus God? And
yeah, they need to fight it out already.
That would spice up the debates.
Yeah, this passive aggressive 2,000-year, we're going to come, needs to just end. Just end it all. Duke it out so we can move on.
Isn't that their goal, though? The rapture and end times?
They want it to happen, but for some reason, it doesn't happen.
Weird.
Well, I don't know why.
Pompeo's totally into this rapture and end times thing because he said that wars that are plaguing the Middle East are a never-ending struggle until the rapture.
Yeah, it's literally the only reason why they care about Israel. It is the sole reason they care about Israel. Why do they think? Because they think is if all Jews return to Israel, that brings on the end times, and then we can go rapture, and then that means free stuff for us atheists.
Well, we can't. We can't rapture.
Well, exactly. That's why we get all the free stuff.
Oh, sweet. Okay.
Well, if they're all raptured, we're left hanging around, and okay, that's cool, right?
So we'd lose, like, I don't know, 30 or 40% of the population?
Well, if you're raptured right now, our newest surveys show that up to like a quarter of Americans actually don't associate with any particular religion.
Yeah, but then also, you wouldn't be talking about like Catholics because obviously they're heretical.
Oh,
so
speaking of Catholics, I've got something super fun for us guys, because the Vatican has launched an electronic smartwatch type product that allows wearers to track their prayers through an app dubbed eRosary. The device activates upon the wearer making the sign of the cross, signaling the start of prayer. Devotees can then select to pray one of three rosaries: standard, contemplative, or thematic. A Vatican press release claims that the $110 device will serve as a tool for learning how to pray the rosary for peace in the world.
I really, really, really hope that the kit edition of this does not have GPS on it.
Well, it definitely has accelerometers.
Because imagine a device that's made by the Vatican that can track little kids.
Oh, no.
No. Yes, we need to. What are the privacy considerations involved in a Vatican-sponsored smartwatch? I think GPS location. It does have an accelerometer, right? Because when you wave your hands.
Yep. It's definitely going to be included in the EULA that we won't read.
Okay. All right. Yep. Just a click to agree.
Yep.
All
click right. to agree.
And will it be in Latin or in the language of the people?
Well, Latin's harder to read, so Latin.
Yes, it'll, but since Vatican II, who knows?
Yeah, they don't do the Latin anymore. It'll probably be in American or English Latinese.
Mel Gibson will elect to download his agreement in Latin because, you know, pre-Vatican II, and he wants it in the truest language. Mm. But guys, this is like the craziest smartwatch ever, and it was only something like 5 years ago that the Pope actually got a Twitter account. Now they've got an entire smartwatch.
But the thing is like, does it even have a display on it?
Oh, a display?
It has like three colors or something like that, or... What? It's not even a smartwatch. It's
no. It's a pray only watch. Contrasting whether it's a smart versus a prayer watch. That might say something that the Vatican doesn't really want said about it. But I'm really interested in what's the contemplative rosary and then what's the thematic rosary. Like, what rosary themes can we have? Is this, I just finished homecoming as a high school teacher, right? And I mean, do we have like crazy hat rosary? Do we have pajama day rosary? Do we have superhero day rosary? Like, what are all the themes that we can? No, it's apparently this is the year of peace in the world. So this is the peace themed rosary. And next year, the thematic rosary will be a forgiving all debts rosary. And the following year after that, it will be like.
So
right
before this $110 device came out, how is it that rosaries worked for prayer then? If you now require it to be a plug-in, a device. So does that mean they were just playing until just now? Are they just now able to talk to God? Is that why?
It's just a more efficient and effective technological way of talking to God.
Oh, okay.
Or it's an improvement. Tracking children and tracking users. You've been listening to Ask an Atheist with Sam Mulvey. Thank you so much, Luke.
Thank you.
Thank you, Josh.
You're welcome.
And thank you to Luke Douglas of the Humanist Society of Greater Phoenix. You can find us and all of our episodes at atheist.radio. You can email us questions at questions@atheist.radio. Find us on Twitter at AskAnAtheistWA and Facebook at the same place. Drop us a voicemail at 844-SKEPTIC. Happy Halloween!